Great to have you along for another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, and my guest today is going to talk with us about organic gardening and organic farming as well. Tony Schultz, organic farmer. He owns Stony Acres Farm in Athens, Wisconsin, a leader in central Wisconsin's local food movement. Very passionate advocate for the family farm. He grows vegetables, herbs, and flowers. And he raises beef, pork, eggs, and grain, and he sells it, or at least some of it, through his through CSAs. You may have had experience with CSAs, a question about it. We can also obviously talk about growing vegetables and flowers organically. We'd love to hear from you with your own questions or comments. I hope you'll join us. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Certainly look forward to hearing from you. And Tony Schultz, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks for having me on, Larry. I'm a longtime listener and honored to be a first-time guest here on The Larry Mueller Show.
It's great to have you here. You want to talk about, well, first talk about your farm. Describe your farm for us.
Sure. Stony Acres Farm is a third-generation family farm. We're in Athens, Wisconsin. If you haven't been there, that's about a half an hour northwest of Wausau. Mm-hmm. We're in the northwest corner of Marathon County. And I grew up on a 50-cow conventional dairy farm, and I met my wife, Kat Becker, at UW-Madison in early 2000s. She was getting her doctorate degree in what was then called rural sociology,
mm-hmm.
and I was finishing my undergrad in education, and I became her case study. She's originally from Manhattan, and we met in college, took a couple classes together, and she told me she daydreamed about having a farm. I said, I have a farm, and so we moved back to the farm in 2006. We bought an 80 from my parents. And we had a vision of making the farm, of sort of reinventing the farm. We had sold our cows in 1998 as part of sort of the ongoing dairy crisis in our state and consolidation of the dairy industry. And we had a plan to reinvent it after being inspired by the local food movement in Madison. At that time, when we graduated from UW-Madison, CSAs were starting to really grow. The farmers market is obviously a gem and perhaps the best farmers market in the country, and there are a number of farmers markets, and there are just so many great farm-to-table things going on in Madison, and we thought, hey, Wausau could support this. So we moved back with the goal of making our farm a diverse, organic, locally-based family farm, and we market our products in a couple of different ways in order to accomplish that.
So you sell direct, you have direct sales?
Yeah, the way we market our products is are in four main ways. Our backbone and what we started and what we originally envisioned was community-supported agriculture. And I'm sure a lot of your listeners by now are familiar with it, but for people who aren't, CSA, community-supported agriculture, sort of works like a subscription program. Like you subscribe to a magazine in the winter or the spring, and then throughout the growing season, instead of getting a magazine, you'd get a box of fresh, seasonal, organic produce delivered to your neighborhood, typically. Some farms are now doing direct door delivery. Some have market pickups. But you're subscribing and taking, buying a share, sort of, in the risk and the bounty of the coming farm season. And that is delivered to you each week. And in addition to that, you'll get some sort of newsletter about what's going on the farm, what's in your box, how to use that. And then on our newsletter, we generally write about some sort of agricultural topic. I'm writing about the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair, which I'll be speaking at this coming week, or something that's going on in the area. And then the farm is really more participatory than what you'd get at the grocery store, definitely, or what you even get at the farmer's market. We make a number of efforts to get people to come out to our CSA throughout the course of the year. We have what we call farm events. So in the spring, we have an all-local food pancake breakfast with everything at the pancake breakfast from the farm or from local farms. We then, at the peak of summer, sort of the beginning of August, we have my favorite night of the year, a barn dance.
Uh-huh.
We have great local band. We have beer from local microbrews. We have organic hors d'oeuvres from the farm. And then in the fall, we have a kind of traditional fall festival. We call it the pumpkin pick and pie. And that's all to get people to come out to the farm, to know their farmer, to experience agriculture, and to establish local connections and improve the way we eat through local agriculture.
Yeah, that's really cool. And the farm-to-table pizza night?
Yeah, that's something we've taken on more recently. We're in our fourth season of farm-to-table pizza. We originally got the idea from our friends through the Farmers Union, Robbie Bannon and Ted Fisher. They are the godmother and godfather of pizza nights. They're over in Pepin County, Wisconsin, closer to the Minnesota border. But they had been doing it since 1998, and they sort of had chef backgrounds, came up to Pepin County, and then were cooking, but also started a farm. They have a small CSA, and more of their revenue and business is about farm-to-table pizza. We thought their idea was really cool and decided to build an oven to sort of have CSA events around. So we'll cook out of there, and then we did a soft opening with it the next year, and then we opened it up to commercial sales just like they were doing, and it has been a great part of our business. It's brought a lot of people to the farm, and everything on our pizzas is from the farm except for the cheese. We don't do dairy anymore, but we get the cheese as locally as we possibly can from Bledsoe's Creamery, which is about 10 minutes away from our house. But all the wheat is grown on our farm. We grind that into flour 2 days before and make it into dough. All of the toppings are coming out of the field, so we have rotating seasonal specials depending on what's in season at our farm. Tonight's pizzas, for instance, have one is called oyster mushrooms. It has greens. It has bacon from our hogs, and it has egg from our chickens cracked on top. We're calling it the spring chick. And then another one is the blue bock. It's got sausage from our pigs. It's got local blue cheese made in Greenwood, Wisconsin, and it has bok choy from our fields. All of our sauce is from our tomatoes, and a lot of it is heirloom sauce coming out of our hoop houses. And we harvest in the morning, we prep it in the afternoon, and we throw it on a pizza at 4:30 every Friday night.
Oh.
So it's as fresh as it can possibly be and as local as it can possibly be.
It sounds so good. It sounds like so much fun.
Yeah, I tell people my only complaint about pizza night is that I want to go to pizza night.
Yeah.
I want to sit on my lawn with a bottle of wine and eat pizza.
Instead, yeah. You've got to work.
Right. I'm hustling in the kitchen, banging out pizza dough as fast as I possibly can. Yeah.
You know, you mentioned tomatoes, and I got a note from John in West Dallas who wondered what types of tomatoes are best to grow organically, or does it make a difference?
I think that's a good question, and you want to select for things that have certain types of disease resistance, early and late blight, although that can be overwhelming to people if that's coming on. And then if you have access to grow indoors, like we have several hoop houses that help supplement our production and extend our seasons, I like to put our heirloom tomatoes in a hoop house. So I love the flavor and complexities of certain heirloom tomatoes like German Johnson, German Rainbow, Cherokee Purples. But I prioritize the hoop house space for them because they're more prone to splitting and lack of production. But they have a controlled environment. They're better to grow. There's some great standard tomatoes that we like for sauce. Bellstar tomato just yields well. It's pretty resistant to most things. And that's something that becomes our default sauce tomato after it comes on in the field. I think that's a good variety. If you're looking for a saladette tomato or a smaller tomato that you can use either in salads or you can use it for sauce, we love Juliet's. But there's also great variegated or striped style saladette tomatoes now, like Pink Tiger, Green Tiger. They're pretty sturdy tomatoes. Then Big Beef is a variety that does well as a big beefsteak, but unfortunately there's not heirloom seed for that yet. So we're using Cayman, which is something that we're working with the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Julie Dawson is doing some great trials, and that's something she sends us a bunch of trials every year, and we report back to her in terms of yields, in terms of taste, and she comes up to the farm and has a pizza night and cuts up a bunch of melons and cucumbers and tomatoes and all the things we trial with the horticulture program and samples them at pizza night, and Cayman has done pretty well.
Oh, man. It all sounds, they sound like wonderful varieties, and I've tried a few. You're right, sometimes older varieties, you risk, I think, a little more in terms of disease and certainly cracking.
Yeah, cracking and just misshapenness, you know.
Yeah.
But sometimes that's appealing. It has its own interesting, unique style. So I don't mind it, and especially if we have that, we sort things that we want to bring to market, and if things are just too weird for people, I don't think they're inferior, but they still make excellent tomato sauce. So that's usually going in our tomato sauce. If things start to crack, if things look misshapen, that's why we have farm-to-table pizza. It's still super fresh. It has great integrity and great taste. It'll just be in the pizza sauce, and you can have it that way.
Having some fun today talking with Tony Schultz, an organic farmer. He owns, his wife owns Stony Acres Farms in Athens, Wisconsin, a leader in the central Wisconsin local food movement. So we're talking with him about his organic farm and about organic vegetable and flower gardening with him. You may have questions, and if you do, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us. The email address is talk@wpr.org, or go ahead and post on our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Next week on Garden Talk, we'll take a look at lawns and lawn care and using organic methods for lawn care, as a matter of fact. Today, we're looking at organic methods for growing vegetables and flowers, and our guest, Tony Schultz, has some great information to share. He's with owns Stony Acres Farms in Athens, Wisconsin, talking with him about CSAs and certainly about how to grow organically. Again, the number 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Just thinking about the average vegetable or flower gardener here in the state, is it tough for them to say, you know what, I'm just going to be organic?
I think that I have an interesting idea about this, is that I am from a conventional dairy farm, so I grew up in that, but I didn't get an education in horticulture or something, or like dairy science necessarily. I have an education degree. My wife has a rural sociology, or it's called community environmental sociology degree, and I tell a lot of people that, I mean, there are definitely advantages to studying it, but I think that going into my own organic farm, transitioning my own farm to organic, it was easier to be hopeful about the potential for organic when I saw it grow and I toured other farms and watched it work than I think some of the formal educational options for agriculture in the state would have you believe, because I think progress a lot of times is centered around control, and organic farming, you have to work with nature a lot of time. And so if you can accept that, if you go into it with that, with a perspective like that, I think that you can make it. And you're definitely going to make mistakes, but I think everybody does. And you just have to grow into things so you don't bite off more than you can chew and become depressed about whatever project you're taking on, no matter how big you might ultimately want it to be. I think growing into it is a good bit of advice for people.
Yeah, and I mean, you have a pretty large farm for an organic farm, I'm saying here. But how did you start?
Well, we started the first year, we grew an acre and a half. And we just wanted to make sure we could get things to come out of the ground. And we were only growing for the Wausau Summer Farmers Market. And then we were using that and our own local social networks. Kat was teaching at UW Marathon County. I am from the Wausau area, and my parents are. And we were using our own social networks to develop CSA, to advertise CSA, to get it going. And then we started small. Our goal was to have 50 shares. But that was also the same year that Michael Pollan wrote his book, The Omnivore's Dilemma. Mm-hmm. And local food got a big boost from that, and just the rising consciousness about local and organic food. And that helped. We ended up taking 72 shares, but we had to cut it off because we didn't want to bite off more than we can chew. And so we grew into that. And we doubled from an acre or an acre and a half, into 3 acres. And then we grew it slowly from there. We're at about 225 shares now that we sell, 10 years into doing CSA. And we decided to start with staples and a base and then grow into other varieties and practice them. And we're always looking to work on expanding that. So lately I've been obsessed with mushrooms and doing more mushroom varieties. We grow wine cap is what I'd recommend to people. They start with the easiest mushroom. You just put it on some wood chips. It comes up in the fall. We've done shiitake, which we take oak sticks from our nearby maple grove and inoculate them in the spring. They come on later. And then I'm farming a lot of oyster mushrooms, which are the most farmable. So taking on things like that and growing into things, I think, is a good way to go about farming. Yeah, we do about 15 acres of vegetables now, but we've cut it off and capped our CSA size because, like I said, we want to maintain the fact that we're a family farm, in which our family, me, my wife, and my father, provide the majority of labor to the farm. We hire some people, one full-time year-round and two seasonal people, but our family's providing the majority of labor to the agricultural operation.
Very cool. And as an aside, I've spent, as a professor here at the University of Wisconsin, did a lot of research with a professor, Don Johnson from Rural Sociology, probably did 30 or 40 community development studies around the state. So I think that is a great department.
It was excellent. Yeah, when I was in school, it was called Rural Sociology. I had some great professors, Michael Bell and Jess Gilbert, excellent mentors for me. And it's since been renamed Community and Environmental Sociology, but I hung out with a lot of people from there and learned a lot. And UW is coming around to a lot of these things. Bill Tracy is doing some great organic research with sweet corn, and Who Gets Kissed is one of the favorite varieties now for sweet corn in the upper Midwest, and that's got a lot of hype at the Organic Farming Conference in La Crosse, the Moses Conference. And the Center for Integrated and CIAS.
Center for Integrated Agricultural Systems.
Exactly. We're on the board, my wife and I, and they're doing excellent work, not just in organic, but anyone who has an agriculture in the state that's doing anything to develop the sustainability of their operation. And it's great to get together with those folks twice a year to see what research is going on, what projects are taking place at the UW.
Absolutely. Well, let's take some calls. Mary in Wausau up first here. Hi, Mary. Thank you for calling.
You're welcome. I just wanted to mention that Kat and Tony were Badgers of the Year for our alumni chapter in Wausau.
Oh!
So not only did they grow wonderful produce, but they are also very good Badgers.
Well, that's kind of a nice honor for you and Kat, Tony.
It was an honor. We have such an outstanding flagship campus, and I learned so much in my time there, not just in the classroom, but in all of the cultural and relationship-based opportunities that you have by attending UW-Madison. And I met my wife there, and I have this incredible woman that I came back to the family farm with in Athens, and where it's in part because of what Madison was able to give us, we have the success that we do.
Mary, thank you so much. Let's turn to Alan in Wausau next. Hi, Alan.
Hi. I have a worm bin that I'm trying. I grew some sweet potatoes. They grow like the vines are growing. I got them to about 3 or 4 feet long, actually. And just in water and then compost from my worm bin. But I'm losing nitrogen. Like, that seems to be the first thing that depletes really quickly. And so I'm wondering what an organic source of nitrogen that I can easily add to keep that up. It seems like everything else is staying up at high levels, but that just goes away quickly.
Hmm. Yeah, that is often, we're often nitrogen constrained on our own farm, and that is the most difficult macronutrient to keep at a sufficient level or a healthy level. But our main source of it is well-rotted cow manure, you know, composted beef manure. We have 50 beef cows and we compost their manure after we clean out their loose housing barn in the spring, and I'm applying that throughout the season. That not only provides some nitrogen, but it applies organic matter, which is essential to soil health, and I think that's the key variable that you want to watch. Do you have a strong organic matter? But for other forms of nitrogen, chicken manure has higher forms of nitrogen, and there are several companies that provide them. We use Fertrell, for instance, which has a nitrogen mix, and then it has a potassium mix, and so you can get mixes that are certified organic. They're normally chicken manure based, and that's what you would see to add nitrogen. But you don't want to over apply some fertilizers, or you can burn roots. So be careful when you're applying these raw fertilizers.
There you go.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Alan, for calling. I appreciate your call. You can join in too with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Again, our phone, 1-800-642-1234. I tell a story. I think I've told this story on the show in the past, but many years ago when I was renting, I rented a farmhouse and wanted to put a garden in, and the farmer said, you know what, the chicken yard was right here. It was sort of near the house. He said, we'll put your garden there. Talk about plant growth.
Yeah, that sounds like old farmer folk wisdom to me. A lot of our neighbors say, oh, the best place to have the garden is right behind where the barn used to be, or right behind where the barn is. And we have chickens, we have 150 laying hens, and we have pigs. And we rotate those animals a season ahead of where we want to have crops for the next year, especially on an organic farm. If something's getting a lot of quack in it, quack grass, and those pigs will root out the quack, but then they're also fertilizing it. The chickens are laying down one of the most intense forms of natural fertility that we have on the farm. So we rotate those animals ahead, a year or two ahead of where we're putting our vegetable crops.
Can pigs really get rid of quack grass?
They're the best rototillers that we have, because if you till quack on an organic farm, you're generally spreading quack.
Yes.
But pigs get in there and they eat that quack root out and they stay on it and they'll keep rooting and rooting and rooting around on it. So I found that if I want to do a quack renovation, what I call it, if I have some asparagus or something, or some sort of perennial crop that's getting quacked up that I feel like I have to rotate, I'll put the pigs there for a season or a season and a half and make sure they dequackify it before I come in with the next vegetable.
Talking with Tony Schultz today. Great to have him with us. And again, you can join in, 800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions and comments. You know, I'm not sure if you are, if you're a peony guy or not, but I did want to mention during the show today that the American Peony Society is sponsoring a trial at the West Madison Agricultural Research Station on West Mineral Point Road in Madison. And they're inviting people to determine which peony cultivar will be awarded the award for landscape merit. So it's something that the folks at the West Madison Gardens wanted me to mention on the show. These are 50 peony varieties. You can see them at the West Madison Display Gardens, and you can vote there. So if you're in that area, there's voting going on now through at least the next week or so. So there you go. And I did want to mention that. We have callers online here, and I guess I'm having a little trouble getting to those calls. So we will instead take a look at some other vegetables in terms of, here's John wondered, if you recommended some tomato varieties, what about pepper varieties? And we're talking about green peppers, he says. So I'm assuming he means the sweet peppers.
Yeah, I think a standard pepper variety that we'd use for a green pepper would be New Ace. And that is generally performed best in the field. We're trying a couple of other more expensive varieties this year because we've added another hoop house, and we're trying to do some peppers in the hoop house, and we wanted to make sure that we could get the best yield out of that agricultural space. And so I believe one of them is Crimson, and that is something, and King is another
King.
One. So those are some varieties. They're more expensive varieties. but they are large, thick-walled, thick-fleshed peppers, and they taste excellent, apparently. But New Ace is a standard green pepper variety that we use for field production.
Judy in Elk Mound has a question. Hi, Judy. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I was wondering about the hormone injection, a BPH hormone injection that a lot of dairy farmers use. And I know recently Grassland and Mullins have requested their farmers to stop using that. I was just wondering if that's a product that you would ever use, or how do they monitor if that's actually in use or not?
We are a certified organic farm, and we, as a certified organic farm, we are not allowed to use GMOs or genetically modified organisms. And you're seeing more and more of this movement, so there's not only a growth in organic food and production and acreage, but there is also, you see in the grocery store now, a lot of non-GMO or GMO-free, you know, labeling. It has a butterfly on it. And people are... turning away from GMOs, I feel like, more and more as I see all the labels in that in the grocery store, the GMO-free label, and in addition to the organic label. But if you're buying organic, you are not getting genetically modified organisms. We have, you know, some objections as organic farmers to GMOs in terms of scientifically, I guess, in terms of species domination. So I guess the scenario is that if you would genetically modify a fish and let that into a natural environment, it could dominate its environment and then become, you know, kill off other species and then be prone to a disease that comes through. And so there's concern about that potential with genetically modifying organisms. But as organic farmers and farmers in general, more of our objection has to do with the proprietary nature of genetically modified organisms. So it's patented and owned, and there have been cases where farmers have not been able to save genetically modified seed, and it's been used to dominate the seed industry and drive up seed prices and put more control in the hands of seed companies. And so that's part of the objection and part of the political objection that we stand on in certifying organic.
Yeah. Thank you, Judy, for calling. Appreciate it. Ellen in Waupun has a question. Hi, Ellen. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have just a garden lettuce that is developing holes in it, and I'm wondering what I should use on that to prevent this.
So a garden leaf lettuce?
Yes, right.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. A regular lettuce. Well, I'm not sure. Generally, our salad mix and lettuces are not prone to, it could be some, is it a slug? Have you noticed any slugs?
It's a little teeny worm.
A little worm, okay. Diatomaceous earth, generally, which will detract, is a sort of like jagged little pill for these worms to crawl around on. That's generally something that we would use if we were concerned about. One time we had cut worms, but I'd have to see the worm that you're describing, but diatomaceous earth will generally drive away worms because if they don't like eating something so jagged, and it can give them really bad indigestion, if you know what I mean. So they stay away from that, and that's been an organic treatment that we can use in that situation.
How is that used?
It's just, you would get it at a garden center, and it comes in as a powder. It's finely ground, and you would mist it on or sprinkle it on your lettuce crop. And then it's a natural product, and you would just, you know, when you harvest your lettuce, you would wash it anyway, so it will wash off.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you'd want to wash it.
I'm not exactly sure what worm, but diatomaceous earth, I think, would be a safe thing to start with. If it were a little bug that lands, you could try using a row cover, which is a thin-spun, you know, fabric that you cover it up. But if the worm is on there, then I try diatomaceous earth.
It's one of those things, too, that you don't want to be inhaling or, you know.
Right.
So just be careful of that, too, because it feels a little dusty, but you don't want it in your lungs.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. We're talking about organic gardening and farming today with Tony Schultz of Stony Acres Farm in Athens, Wisconsin. He's going to be speaking as a matter of fact, at the Energy Fair on June 18th. He's actually the keynote speaker on Saturday, June 18th at 9 a.m. on the main stage during the Organic Valley Breakfast. So that's going to be kind of fun.
Yeah, I look forward. We always attend the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair on Saturday. But this year I have the honor of speaking, and I'm doing the Organic Valley Breakfast Saturday morning. And I'll be talking about the sustainability of small-scale organic farming, sort of giving a small is beautiful talk and how small-scale organic farming has the potential to be more sustainable and has potential to be better for the environment and how it should be pursued. And I also want to talk about expanding the local food movement. And I think one of the things that we need to do in this state and around the nation is to grow the number of farms that we have, not mm-hmm. grow the number of products necessarily, but that will happen as well, but grow the number of farmers that we have. And there's niches to be filled, there's diversity to be gained by increasing the amount of farmers that we have. So I know Madison has done an excellent job with their local food movement and bringing local food into the area, but there are a lot of underserved local food areas in this state that would love to have a CSA, and this niche is waiting to be filled. And there are other small farm niches to be filled. I think one of the things that's about to explode in the farm is something I'm calling micro dairies.
Ah.
15 cows, a farmstead cheese or creamery that sells directly, and because they capture the value of what they're producing in their local marketplace, that's all you need. And I see the potential of this. There's two now in Athens, where I'm from, and there. I think just like CSAs have boomed in the last 10 years, I think micro dairies have a lot of potential in the state. So local food, sustainability of small farms, and on our own farm, we have we're in the middle of a 5-year plan to be energy neutral. So we've invested in solar. We have an 8-kilowatt system that does about 70%. Of our electricity bill. Next year, we're going to go to a 14-kilowatt system and eliminate our electricity bill. And we've also invested in wood gasification, which is like a super efficient wood boiler system. And before we had it, we would just heat our house with 12 cords of firewood. Afterwards, we installed the system to heat our house, our pack shed, which is like a barn type that we do our vegetables in, and our greenhouse, which is 72 by 22. And we still use that same 12 cords of firewood to heat all those spaces. So energy efficiency, energy neutrality, something that we care about. And I not only want to have an energy neutral, diverse, organic, local family farm, I want to grow this movement. I want there to be more and more diverse, organic, local family farms all over the countryside, rebuilding the family farm economy with local and organics.
You think back, and just going back to the rural sociology class that I took, I remember looking at the size and number of farms in the state is probably 10%, maybe 20% of what it was 50 years ago.
Right. In the 50s, we had 50,000, around 50,000 family farms.
Yeah.
And now in this last year, we've fallen under 10,000. And to me, that is a tragedy. And it doesn't have to be that way. Part of it is changing technological regimes. But more of it, I think, is just concentration and consolidation in the dairy industry, and that comes down to the level of production. But we're seeing all kinds of environmental issues with CAFOs, water quality, manure issues around the state that come up constantly and are constantly challenged. But no one's challenging 50-cow dairy farms. We need to sustain those farmers, and we need to provide opportunities for them. Organic has been one great opportunity, the organic market and Organic Valley. We have this great cooperative. But I think there's going to be other locally based opportunities showing up for dairy farms, in addition to vegetable farms and other types of niches that need to be filled in the state.
Mm-hmm. Eileen in Madison has a comment or question. Hi, Eileen. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks. Yes, I have a question. A friend of mine told me that sometimes...
Oh! Oh, we completely lost her. Eileen, you...
I'm here.
Oh, okay. Go ahead. Try again. You know what? We can't. I'm sorry, Eileen. We're just not coming through. Her question, I know, her question had to do with plants sold in the big box stores. You know, the garden, I don't know, tomato plants or whatever. What are your thoughts on those plants?
Well, a couple years ago, there was a serious tomato blight issue that came about because of plants sold at Walmart. And it, because Walmart is so large and their production system is so centralized, they spread blight all over the country. I don't know if you remember. This is probably like 2012. And so I think that might be what she's referring to. So that is a part of the risk of concentration, is that when you concentrate production, if there's a problem at the point of concentration, like with the tomato blight or with egg recalls or spinach recalls, then it's a problem for all of that food for that time or that season. And that's another reason to embrace localized production systems, diversity. And if that's the question, yeah, you're speaking to me. So diversify, broaden our sources, and get things locally.
Thanks, Eileen, for calling. I'm sorry we just couldn't get your voice through there. Becky in Rio has a question. Hi, Becky.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm interested in some organic weed control for a very large asparagus bed. The oldest part of the bed is about 30 years old, but I've added new sections to it over the years with newer, better varieties. But it's just a constant problem to keep the weeds out of there. And the asparagus grows much better in a weed-free bed. What are your thoughts?
Mm-hmm. So tell me about it. We have tried establishing asparagus on our farm 3 times. We will be doing it again next season. And I think, first of all, I need to adjust my thinking about asparagus. You can't think of it like a perennial. You have to think of it like an annual that lasts all season and many seasons. And so I think adjusting my thinking going forward is going to help, because my asparagus patch, like yours maybe, can get prone to quackgrass. But timely mowing, timely weeding, and cultivation, you know, you just have to stay on it and outlive it, really. I spend a lot of my time on my hands and knees taking care of things, and perennials are no different. So, but after the season, when it comes up, you just have to continue to mow it vigilantly, and you can have a better establishment, a better weed establishment or a grass establishment than if you'd have quackgrass come in. So if you vigilantly mow it. I think that's one method we're going to try.
And by mow, you mean pretty constant?
Yes, pretty regularly, yes. You have to let it come up because it needs energy in the root system, but after the season, you have to mow it.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Becky, for calling. Appreciate it.
If you mow it down, you're not letting it establish a good root base.
I know.
For the following year.
Yes, it is a trade-off. So after the season, you have to mow it, then you let it come back up, you cultivate, but you have to get a good mowing in a couple times, though.
Yeah.
It's necessary with an organic patch. It depends what kind of weed regime you have, though, I feel like.
Yeah, but if you've got quackgrass,
yeah,
you're kind of sunk otherwise. Thanks, Becky. Gary in Hebron, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I'm thinking about putting in some fruit trees, and I wondered if I could buy them just anywhere and try and call them organic when I grow them. And will they grow in a small pot and then transplant later? And the other question is, how do they do through the winter?
These are excellent questions. So the first part, getting them anywhere. You can, but you want to get them where they are grown in a zone that is similar to your zone or colder. So I'm almost in zone 3 up here in the northwest corner of Marathon County. If you look at a zone map, the finger dips down. So we always get zone 3 plants from a nursery that is grown in zone 3. And that's important in terms of selecting your stock, because if you want them to last through the winter and be hardy enough for your climate, they have to, you have to select for where, what zone they are cultivated in and grown in. Going from a pot to the field is fine. As soon as you get them, you generally want to put them in the place where you have them, though, because that will allow for a more healthy root system to develop, and water them regularly in your first year.
Okay. Well, that does it. I think I've got the input. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And the trees of that size, too, you're probably going to want to protect them from deer, unless you're in a place where there aren't any, for sure. We have callers online. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mealer Show as we talk organic vegetable gardening and farming with Tony Schultz.
Larry.
Yes.
Can I get in a quick deer story for the folks out there? Do you mind, or do we have to talk?
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back, and I want that deer story.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Talking here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we talk organic vegetable gardening and farming with Tony Schultz of Stony Acres Farm in Athens, Wisconsin. He will be speaking, I want to mention this again, on the main stage during the Organic Valley Breakfast at the Energy Fair. You know, there's like over 15,000 people get together, and it's really a wonderful wonderful event. I've been there many times and I've always enjoyed it. And that's coming up on June 18th, 9 o'clock at the main stage. And we were just talking about deer before our little break here. And Tony, you've got a deer story for us.
I do, Larry. I'm a regular listener of Garden Talk. And I often hear people calling in with questions about deer and what to do with deer. I think you've probably dedicated whole shows to it, probably. But I have to tell you my deer advice. So, first of all, I want to get the practical, logical advice out of the way. A good fence, right? And this is the easiest thing to do, whether it's one tree and you have to put a fence around that tree, or if you're doing a garden and you're struggling with deer, you have to fence out deer with a fence that's firm enough and tall enough to keep them out. And that's what the DNR recommends, and et cetera. And so we had some issues with deer. We have about 12 to 15 acres of vegetables every year. About 6 years ago when our patch was about 5 acres, and a deer came down when our edamame, which is like an edible soybean, came down at night and ate about half, just went down the row. Our edamame was about 4 inches tall.
Oh, no.
And they just nibbled half of it off. And so we lost half our edamame patch. So we called the DNR, and there's a program within the state. I think it's through the Department of Agriculture. I'm sorry, but there's a program that they administer through the state where they give you a fence if you've claimed loss on agricultural production. And you came in, and we put up this fence, and it was okay. You know, the deer, it didn't stop them. I think it was just a one-time thing. But in thinking about it, since we have not really had deer issues, and I was thinking about what we've done, because we've tried cutting our hair and throwing it around the perimeter, or playing loud right-wing talk radio at night, and that trying to keep the bears and deer away, or the deer away with that. But what ultimately think happened is that our neighbor established, he's a beekeeper, and he wanted to put hives on our farm, and we said, that's great, we'll get pollinators. He gave us a little bit of honey. He gets an organic farm where the bees can run around and carry pollen in, and we have lots of pollinating opportunities. But by putting the bees on the north side of the farm, which is where the woods is, and the deer would come from, he also attracted a big sow black bear with two cubs every year, and it would paces around on the north perimeter of our farm as part of its territory, and there's bear scat, and the bear is there, and I see it once in a while when I walk the north side of our farm. So I tell people, if you want to get rid of deer, get a bear.
Oh, okay, my goodness.
I've answered the question for all time.
Wow. It's like, you know, you were talking about mushrooms earlier, and I once got a book on mushroom growing, and they recommended that you used elephant manure. And I thought, well, yeah, where am I going to get elephant?
It's like, where am I going to get a bear? Where am I going to get elephant manure?
You're going to need a really big fence for the elephant, Larry.
Bob in Columbus, thanks a lot for calling. Hi.
Hi, Tony. Larry, I got a question on flea beetles. I don't know if you've got them up north there, but 30 years ago, you never saw them around here. It's a very little shiny metallic beetle that eats the heck out of your brassica. It's just riddling my cabbage, broccoli, cauliflower.
Yes.
I've been covering them. I wonder how to take care of them.
Yeah. So we have four major pests on our farm that we have to use mainly cultural and physical methods to deal with. But flea beetles are perhaps the most threatening because they love tiny brassica family. So anything in the cabbage family, broccoli, cauliflower, small Asian greens, flea beetles are all over them. And they're especially threatening if you direct seed things. So we're direct seeding a lot of Mizuna, braising mix, things of that nature for salad greens and wilting greens and braising greens. And we plant them, and you mentioned covering. This is the main way we deal with them. As soon as you plant it, you have to have the row cover out and cover it because these are quick crops that come up. They're only like 25 days, and they come up very quickly. You have to have the row cover out right behind the seeder, and you have to throw the row cover on, and you seal the edge. You can't just pin it down because the flea beetles will get underneath it. So it has to be a full seal. It doesn't have to be very thick, but you have to seal it.
How do they overwinter?
How do flea beetles overwinter?
Yeah.
Oh, I imagine they just, I don't know. I'm not sure of the physiology of our... how flea beetles go through the winter, but their breeding cycle is in, you know, like late May, early June. So later in the summer, flea beetles aren't as much of a problem. But it's at this time of year that flea beetles are a major problem. So row cover is the main way. We invest in a good amount of row cover for our early crops. The other thing is when I'm planting kale and broccoli, cabbage, cauliflower, I want those starter plants. I'm doing them as starters, and I want them to be a little bigger. If they're a little bigger, they'll get some aesthetic damage, but a kale will grow out of that, and cabbage, you won't even notice that if the transplant is big enough, if it's healthy enough when you put it out in the field. So I'm talking like 4 inches or 3.5 inches out of its cell, a starter cell, if you're doing a transplant. Make sure that's big enough, and it can usually withstand a flea beetle attack. If you're worried about it, if you feel like it's too heavy, then you have to cover right when you put them out.
A tip of your asparagus, plant it deep, about maybe 8-10 inches, backfill it as it grows up, and then you can go over the top of it in the spring with either a rototiller or a disc.
Ah, that's perfect. Great. Thank you. I'm looking for people to actually call in and help me on this because asparagus has been something I've had trouble with as a grower.
And isn't it? Oh, and it's so wonderful to have. And for you in particular, I think for resale would be wonderful.
Oh, yeah. It's a seasonal rite of passage to have that asparagus. And to have it in CSA up here in Zone 3 is more difficult. We're on a Madison-style schedule where we start in the beginning of June and go through October. But we've, invested in a lot of hoop houses to do it. But I really treasure things that come out of the ground in spring. Rhubarb, I'm such a huge rhubarb fan because of that. And because of asparagus, because of when it comes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm working on establishing that crop again.
Dick in Deerfield, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
My question is horse manure. How do you process it? Is it worth processing for garden?
Okay. Is horse manure a good fertilizer for the garden, and how do you process it?
Definitely. Horse manure probably has a lot of organic matter built right into it with the way horses eat, and it breaks apart. I would compost it a little bit. I have taken horse manure off other people's farms, and I did that one year from my neighbor who has horses, and he said, "You want to take my manure?" And I spread it right onto my field, and I brought in some chickweed with it. Some of it was older, and some of it was newer, but I brought in some of his chickweed, and now I have some chickweed on my farm that I know came in with that horse manure. So composting it, turning it, and as you turn it, you can add in some other organic matter to help it break down.
And sometimes I think that I was thinking that very thing when you were talking, when the question came up, because I was thinking, no, weeds right in the manure itself.
Exactly. That's why we want to give it time to heat up. It kills those weed seeds, you know. And if you have a soil or a thermometer that you can stick in there, we have a soil thermometer that we use in our compost pile, and it's about has about an 18-inch long stem that we test to make sure our pile is about 150 degrees, or we can get it to 140 degrees where the weed seeds are getting burned.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Dick. And Debbie, thanks for calling in Eau Claire.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. I have a 10 by 20 raised vegetable garden, and every year I compost, or not compost, I mulch with grass clippings from my lawn. And I've done this for probably about 10 years, and I'm just wondering how much is too much of that mulch on that, mulching on my garden.
It's hard to, for grass clippings, it'd be hard to get too much, I think.
I think so, too. I think you're adding a great source of, again, organic matter, organic matter, organic matter. As an organic farmer, that's our what we're trying to establish. And, you know, sometimes if you're trying to put it over a crop that you want it to come through, you can smother that. But I know we put on 6 inches of, we use straw, but we did 6 inches of straw on our garlic, and it still comes through there. Grass clippings can mat down a little bit, so you want to be careful if you're mulching things in the fall with that to uncover or to make sure things are coming through. It can get a little mattier.
Talking today with Tony Schultz, who is an organic farmer and owner of Stony Acres Farm, for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. On this edition of Garden Talk, we're taking a look at organic gardening and organic farming with Tony Schultz. Organic farmer, owns Stony Acres Farm in Athens, Wisconsin, leader in central Wisconsin's local food movement. He's a passionate advocate for the family farm. Great to have him along. You may have questions about gardening or farming organically, and I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mealer Show. I'd love to hear from you. And Tony Schultz, again, thanks so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
I have some Facebook and email questions I wanted to bring up. Hank posted on Facebook that he has a large raspberry patch, but it doesn't seem to produce berries. Should he cut them back? Are there organic maintenance tips that you could recommend? Raspberry.
Yeah, that was the crown jewel of our farm. And I have to apologize for the background noise, too. I do not have a landline, so I'm sitting in my Amish neighbor's phone shack.
Ah, that's fine.
And they're peeling hay right next to me.
That's all right.
But raspberries was a crown jewel of our farm. It was the first thing when we moved back to the farm that we planted. I love eating raspberries, and I'm also, just for your listening audience, I wanted to tell you I'm the fastest raspberry picker in Marathon County. But we had an issue with 2012. The winter was very mild, and I feel like the plants didn't know when to come into dormancy and didn't know when to go out of dormancy because we had a warm spring in early March. If you remember, it was 85 degrees in the first weekend of March, ruined maple syrup season. And then the raspberries were starting to come up, and April was kind of average, and it allowed some root fungus issues to come on. And so there were... The plants did not look as good. There was still foliage, but the fruit production almost fell to nothing. So
wow.
I feel like if that is the situation, I don't know how long they've not been producing, but you need to start over. I'm told by Brian Smith, who is the horticulture director, and he researches berries at blueberries, raspberries, and strawberries at River Falls University, that when thinking about raspberries, and we think about them in part for commercial production, you should think, 8, 7, 9 years, maybe something like that. And so raspberries can start to wane. I know there are some people that have raspberry patches for 40 years, but sometimes they're just going to wane, and you want to renovate, and you want to start over. So I think if there's just foliage and you're not having berries, it's time to start over and don't go right back into the same spot. Probably want to wait a couple of years. Try and find another area with decent drainage to establish your raspberry patch.
Tom is good advice, I think. Tom in Barham, Minnesota, would like to hear your philosophy in regard to the use of supplemental water in your fields?
Yeah, that's a great question. We are at 12 acres of vegetables this year, and we have gotten to the point on our farm that we need to think seriously about irrigation. But water is a huge issue, not only in California, which has been suffering this dramatic drought and has affected vegetable production and vegetable distribution throughout the country, but in, even in a place like Wisconsin, where we're water-rich, but we have different water pockets and geography and topography. The most water we can get out of our well, for instance, is 9 gallons per minute, and the most anyone in my area here in the town of Bern can get out is probably 20 gallons a minute. So there's, we don't have a ton of water. We have water, but we don't have that heavy water capacity where people can pump 200 gallons a minute out in other parts of the state. But we do have to irrigate, and we have a heavier soil, so we don't have to irrigate much. Last year, it rained perfectly. I often joke with people that all I want is it for it to rain every Sunday night, an inch from midnight to 6 a.m. That's all I ask for in the world. But that almost happened last year, so it was pretty good. I had to irrigate about 14 days of the season. What I do is we have drip for anything that's in a row, and that's a very efficient water system. You can get these, it's called T-tape, or there's different brands of it, like we use Aquatrax, and that drips out very efficiently and puts water directly into the ground with very little water loss. But some things you can't efficiently put drip down, and I do overhead. I only run overhead at night. I feel like if I'm running overhead on an 80-degree day, I've lost so much of it to evaporation that it's not worth running the pump. It's a waste of time. It doesn't adequately water. So I will run in through the middle of the night. Last year I had to do it with a Fleet Farm sprinkler. This year we bought an irrigation gun. But I'll turn it on at about 7 o'clock at night, and then I can run it through the night. I don't like to irrigate if I don't have to, but you need a certain amount of soil moisture in order to make a plant produce optimally.
Jim in Wausau has a comment next. Jim, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I just have a comment about keeping deer out of your garden.
Yeah.
We have a lot of vegetable gardens and a lot of deer. What I did is put a wrap fence around the bottom, a two-footer. Above that, I have either three or four electric wires. And in spring, when the deer start coming around, you hang aluminum foil with peanut butter on it. And they get their nose shocked a couple times, and pretty soon you don't even need to have the fencer on. And they stay away.
The training of the deer, yes. I've heard the peanut butter trick as well.
And I got it from Leo Martin, who was former extension agent here in Wausau, and one of our neighbors before he died.
Very, very, very cool. If you can do that, and I've heard other people with that same suggestion. And Tony, it's maybe a little work to set up.
Yeah.
But once it's there.
Right. You know, it depends on what kind of war you want to be raging with the deer, I guess. But, yes, I've heard that as well. And it would drive me nuts to have an adverse relationship with peanut butter.
Tom in West Bend, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi there. Has anybody tried corn gluten to keep the weeds down in asparagus?
Corn gluten, because it changes the acidity of the soil? No. Generally, we have not tried that because of the amount that we'd have to apply to the patch. And I've heard of the similar methods with keeping Quackdown, with like using vinegar, because it changes the acidity and makes it uninhabitable. But we have not tried it. We've just done, you know, cultivating hands and knees, mowing, you know, physical methods of dealing with that. Oh. How has it worked for you?
Well, on a very small patch, yes.
Okay.
But I understand your constraints.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks. Oh, so for the average gardener with a small bed, that could work.
Right.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate that call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We have, here's a question from Margaret in Cambridge, an email. She wondered about the economic sustainability of the family farm. Many in her area require someone to work off the farm to keep the farm solvent, and I suppose for health insurance as well. Do you find this to be, do you have similar experiences?
Oh, definitely. I mean, my mom was a teacher growing up. That was important that we supplemented our income, and not only that, for health insurance. You know, with, some farmers just call it the insurance job. And also, as we grew into our farm, my wife and I both worked on farm exclusively for the last 3 years, but she was a professor at UW-Marathon County for health insurance as we grew into it. Farmers have traditionally struggled with, in terms of the economic sustainability, the three M's, Jess Gilbert would tell me, the markets, money, and middlemen. And so markets have been incredibly consolidated. There's not many places to sell your milk to, and if there's not competition at that end of the marketplace, then the price that you're getting for your milk is going to suffer. Middlemen, you know, John Kennedy said that farmers are the only people who pay retail, buy retail, pay wholesale, and pay freight both ways. You know, so the middlemen that farmers have to have so many input costs make the margins very thin. And then money, it's also about leveraging credit if you're a small family farm in the face of a market that is growing and consolidating. So bankers now are increasingly less prone to lend people money. I think one of the bright spots in all of this is direct sales, because for me, having a CSA deals with these three M's. It deals with markets and that my market is local. And if it's local, I capture all of the value, and they receive all of the value. So I'm capturing more of the value, and I'm establishing relationships with people who are buying my food. I don't have as many middlemen to pay for because I am direct marketing things, and I'm not paying for distributors to handle the produce and take the value, or grocery stores to hold it. I do sell in some grocery stores, but that's not my main source of revenue. And money, CSA, people give you a check in the winter or spring, so it helps break the cycle of seasonal debt that a lot of farmers have to deal with. So I think the local food movement does a lot to help deal with the three M's that so many family-scale farmers face with. And that's why I'm excited to see what's happening with micro dairies. I'm excited to see how CSA has provided a home for so many family farms, and farmers markets have boomed, and local restaurants have taken off. I think that's answering a lot of that question.
Yeah, I would agree. Mike in Madison has a question. Mike, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, good afternoon. I've had an issue for a while now with horseradish. I planted it a few years back.
Oh.
And now I don't want it now, and I can't get rid of it. Last fall, I dug down almost 5 feet deep to try and get all the roots out, and it has come back with a vengeance. And it's right next to some other, it's right next to my asparagus patch, and I really don't want to have to use Roundup, but I'm at a loss on how else to get rid of it.
Yeah, if you have the ability to cultivate it regularly, like especially with a deeper shank, like a chisel plow shank or a subsoiling shank, if you hit it a couple times, or if you cultivate it regularly to disrupt early growth, you know, it's a matter of staying on top of it, I think. I planted some of it in my lawn, and I've been mowing it as I mow my lawn every week because we want to move the horseradish patch. We only use it for our personal family consumption, and I might take a root or two to the farmer's market if somebody asks me. But I need to move the patch because our farm is changing, and so I just found that mowing, you know, being regular about trying to get rid of it has I'm winning. You know, it's going to take a little while, but I'm winning either through cultivation or through mowing.
Yeah, I had it. I planted it once too, which I consider one of the biggest gardening mistakes of my life. I would, if I ever planted it again, it would be in some sort of a container where it couldn't grow, get away. It's terrible once it gets going. Thanks, Mike. Mike in Denmark also has a question. Hi, Mike.
Hi, guys. Hey, I was wondering, I have different kind of fruit trees, pear trees, plum trees, and apple trees. And I keep having a problem with aphids, and I was told that a soap spray with maybe a couple of canola oil would take care of that. You guys have any recommendations?
I've heard that as an organic method as well. And when we first moved back to our farm, we were worried about Colorado potato beetles. And we tried mixing soap because it's a silicate, and the pest will slip off the leaves. And so use an organic soap. And what we would do is you blend soap, garlic oil, because the allium family has all those sulfur compounds that act as their own, pest deterrent. And then what we would slap the potato beetles off and grind them up and mix and put them on, because no one wants to see limbs of your dead relatives as you're having your dinner. I guess that's the theory about that. But we would mix that all together and put it on top of the plant. And we had tried that, but we ended up just slapping them off regularly during the breeding cycle seemed to work. If you have something at that scale, you should be able to handle it with some physical work. But I have seen soap as a silicate. I didn't think that it worked that well for us, and we ended up just being more vigilant about knocking the bugs back into a pail and feeding them to the chickens, during the breeding cycle.
And so how do you do that? Because I got probably 20 apple trees and some cherry trees and plum trees. How do you just slap the branches? How do you knock them back?
Well, yeah, I was using potatoes as the example, so it's probably not very good. But if you can get around the tree and knock them off, slapping them down into a pail or container, but I imagine that's more physically difficult. I don't know, but 20 is possible. That'd be the physical way of dealing with it, I guess.
Okay, thanks a lot, Mike, for calling. And let's turn to Alex in Madison. Alex, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you for taking me. I'm working this summer at a scout camp. I have a great opportunity to run a small organic garden up there, Bear Claw Scout Camp up in northern Wisconsin. So, kind of teaching myself little by little. So, if someone with your experience, I guess my question is, wearing my shoes, teaching, thousands of kids. This summer, what are one or two big key points in terms of gardening and sustainability that really stand out to you as things worthy of teaching and learning about?
Yeah, that is excellent. I'm glad you have that opportunity to do that. The first is to have a garden, because I think, encouraging people to have a garden, because it's so good for your health to have a garden, and it's so economically efficient to have a garden. I think it's like a 17-to-1 return that you can get on a garden. And I think about growing a garden, and so giving people practical advice then is, with a garden, you should have a compost pile. You should be looking at the soil health. And a lot of people think of organic as no spray, right? And that, I think that's a safe thing for people to have, although there are organic pesticides and herbicides. But really the heart of organic, and what we spend a lot of time with detailing in our organic certification, is soil health. Soil health, soil health, soil health. Feeding the soil, building the soil, using organic components, manures and grass clippings and mulches to build your soil health. Because if there's organic matter, the soil is alive and nutrients can be fed through that and are accessible to the life of the soil in order to feed that into your plant and your root system. So making sure your soil is healthy and dealing with things in a cultural way before you would ever have to deal with them in a chemical way. So what can I do in terms of rotating my crops, in terms of partnering crops, in terms of having companion planting on my farm that will not have... Don't put me in a situation where I'd ever have to use a chemical. So thinking about a cultural strategy, a way of setting up your garden that makes it sustainable, makes it much more likely to be sustainable than dealing with it in a chemical fashion.
There we go. And, just to kind of go along with this thinking that way, Barbara from Richland County called in about her raspberry crop. They were having problems with their raspberry fruits, getting fruiting, But they switched to fall berries from spring berries and had a lot better luck.
That's good. That's a good piece of advice, too. I've heard that the people are having some good success in my neck of the woods with fall berries because they can come on later in the season, have more time to establish. They can put hold their canopy on longer through the summer. And then you have a crop that a lot of people don't have necessarily at farmers markets in the winter. So I think that's good. Also, rotating your varieties when you're renovating is another good thing to think about, because if one variety was not working, you're losing a crop. Well, another variety, having a cultural disposition toward how you're dealing with it, changing varieties is a good strategy.
Yeah, absolutely. Alex, thanks. I appreciate your call. And Rod and Weyerhauser, we'll go to you next. Hi, Rod.
Hello. Yeah, could you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, see, my phone is kind of screwed up. But anyhow, my question was, I've got the smaller blueberry patch and the smaller asparagus patch. And I mentioned to a person in Walmart about, trying that, salt, Epsom salt. And he said, oh, yeah. He said, if you put that on, you got it sparingly because it keeps the weeds down. I was wondering
if you would do that, Tony.
I've never used Epsom salt myself, but I know that many conventional fertilizers, for instance, are salt based, and some people use salt in order to activate soils. And I don't have any personal experience with it, but I've heard of it anecdotally. So that's all I can say about that.
All right, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And boy, Tony, here we are. About out of time, and you are should bring this up again. You're the keynote speaker on June 18th, 9 in the morning, and this is at the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair. The main stage during the Organic Valley Breakfast.
Yeah, I hope you can come up. It's a great event. There's many great vendors and workshops at the MREA. It's very family friendly. There's a kids' tent. There, we have three little kids on our farm, and we always bring them down. They have a great time while we trade off going to workshops and listening to keynotes. And I'm so happy, I'm so honored to be asked to speak this year. Sustainability is the core of what we're doing here on the family farm, and I'm happy to be sharing that with people.
And how many, again, somebody else wondered how many you have in your CSAs?
We have 225 members in our CSA.
Oh, that's a good size. That's a good size CSA. Sometime I have to get you back and talk some more about the CSAs and how you work it, and go into some more depth on that side of the farm.
Sure, I'd love to. I hope I was good enough today on Garden Talk. I know you often have some really excellent experts on the show today. I'm a farmer, but it's really my wife, who's originally from New York City, I said, but she is the horticulturalist. She is the great variety expert on our farm. Kat Becker, I have to give this shout-out to her today because she is so awesome, and I am such a lucky man to have brought in such a wonderful farmer. I basically lift heavy things on the farm, but she makes the whole thing happen.
So in that case, you bring her along the next time, and you both be with us. That would be wonderful. Tony, I'm out of time. Thanks so much again for being with us. And we'll have you on another day and talk about CSAs, among other things. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.